Word of mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. The average American vehicle spends a whopping 95% of its road life parked. And yet, for all the engineers and urban planners who study how humans and cars interact on the road, one man stands out as an authority on how our lives, towns, and experiences are affected once those cars stop. Donald Shoup is a Yale-trained economist, former chair of UCLA's Department of Urban Planning, and author of The High Cost of Free Parking. Word of Mouth's Rebecca Lavoie spoke to Donald Shoup from his office in California. She asked him what it is about parking that seems to set people back a few evolutionary steps.
Well, I'm not a brain scientist, but I think that most thinking about parking seems to take place in the brain's reptilian cortex, which is the most primitive part of the brain, responsible for making snap decisions about urgent fight or flight choices, such as how to avoid being eaten. And I think this reptilian cortex, which is the first part of the brain to have been developed, and it's the most primitive part, is said to govern instinctive behavior involved in aggression and dominance and territoriality and ritual display. And I think all of these are important factors in hunting for parking and debating about parking policies.
Politics does play into parking. You see this come up at city councils. You see it come up, you know, in town ordinances. Is there a partisan slant to issues surrounding parking? I mean, do progressives favor meters and Republicans favor free spaces?
I don't think parking is a particularly partisan problem. I've seen staunch conservatives become ardent communists when it comes to parking, and rational people quickly turn emotional. That's why I try to focus on reforms that most people can see as in their individual self-interest. And basically, the reform that's been most popular has two parts. One, to set the right price for curb parking, which is the lowest price the city can charge and still have one or two open spaces on every block. So the price is too high if many spaces are vacant, and too low if no spaces are vacant. You can call this the Goldilocks principle of parking prices. So the right price for curb parking is like the Supreme Court's definition of pornography. I know it when I see it. And can anybody recommend a better way to set the price of curb parking?
You are the parking guru, so you probably do actually know it when you see it.
Well, if you see that that's reasonable, I think the second half of the reform is to make it popular. And that second half is using all the meter revenue to repair and clean the sidewalks and plant and trim street trees and improve security. And in your part of the world, I suppose, to remove snow. So the residents of the meter block see the meter money at work on their behalf. And one new twist that has made this policy even more popular is to use the meters to provide free Wi-Fi for everyone on the metered blocks. The meters have to communicate with City Hall to validate credit cards and report occupancy and the like. And some cities use Wi-Fi to communicate with the meters. And they've found that there's a lot of excess capacity in the Wi-Fi system, so they can open it up to everyone within range. So restaurants and coffee shops that used to pay for Wi-Fi can cancel their own Wi-Fi arrangements, and they post signs in the windows advertising free Wi-Fi courtesy of the parking meter program.
Now, this is something that I know we've struggled with here in New Hampshire. There was a city, Keene, New Hampshire, who recently experimented with computerized parking kiosks. It was met with so much animosity by residents that the project was scrapped. In a letter to the city, one blogger wrote, "This system completely eliminates the concept of a great parking spot. It's no longer in front of your store because you still have to go out of your way to get to the kiosk." Is this more about the change itself to the routine than the actual technology that's being implemented?
Well, I think it's both. Some drivers say they have good parking karma, and they may think this is a rare gift rather than pure chance. But setting the right price for parking can give every driver the gift of good parking karma. If there's one or two vacant spaces open on every block, everybody will be able to find a space right at their destination. So I think if Keene, the city that you're talking about, had used all the meter money to pay for added public services on the metered blocks and had offered everyone on the block free Wi-Fi, I suspect that all the merchants would have demanded the meters. And in terms of being inconvenient to use and having to walk to a kiosk and pay for it and ruining your day because of that, new technology gets rid of even that problem because the newer systems allow drivers to use their cell phones to pay for curb parking. You can do it right in your car. So if it's raining or snowing, you don't have to deal with a kiosk. You could even pay for parking after you get into a restaurant. Say the MTA in Boston started this at their park and ride lots. Drivers had to pay for parking at kiosks, and they said that it made them miss trains, you know, which is a real problem. So now drivers can rush right onto the train and use the pay-by-cell phone after they board.
I'm talking about the ins and outs of parking with UCLA professor and parking guru Donald Shoup. He's author of The High Cost of Free Parking. You know, let's talk about that cost. You're not talking about parking at the driver level, those costs. You're talking about much larger costs. Could you run through a few of those for us?
One of the costs is that if there's no parking available, people drive around and around the block hoping to see a vacant space open up. And I suppose this is probably a problem in some small historic towns that were built without a lot of off-street parking, especially when there are a lot of tourists. So if there are no curb spaces open, people drive around and curse the traffic and stare at taillights and expect to park free wherever they get. So I think this driving around wastes energy and wastes time and creates congestion and pollutes the air and interferes with pedestrians and doesn't do anybody any good.
You know, you were talking about, you know, people looking for that free space. It makes me think of some cities like Miami. They have a flourishing public transit system, and one of the components of that is free parking in the lots for the rail system. So can we reverse this? Can we use free parking as incentive to change the commuting habits of people?
Well, just because the driver doesn't pay for free parking, it doesn't mean the cost goes away. Somebody has to pay for it, and that somebody is everybody. So if the drivers don't pay for parking, well, who does pay for it? Well, does the people who pay to ride on the train. They have to include it in the price of the train, and that means people who walked or took the bus to the train are paying for the parking for the people who drove. So I think just because it seems free doesn't mean that the cost goes away. The cost is still there and is paid for by everybody.
In the 1960s, Garrett Hardin used parking to illustrate something he called the tragedy of the commons. Now, he was talking about overpopulation and its impact on the environment. He talked about how the city of Leominster, Massachusetts, wrapped up their parking meters like gifts during the Christmas shopping season. And they made parking once again part of that city's commons. You know, there was a huge short-term gain. It was very popular, but obviously not sustainable. What would it take for people to view parking spaces as something other than these commons that they feel entitled should be free for everybody?
Well, a lot of cities do this, of putting bags over their meters at Christmas and say the free parking courtesy of the mayor and city council. Well, it sounds like a generous offer, but what you're doing is you're making it free at the time of the peak demand. You know, they will tell businesses to encourage your employees not to park free at the meters and take up the spaces that the customers could use, but good luck with that. And anybody who finds the space will just squat there for as long as possible. And it makes it even harder to find a space at the peak time of the year. So I don't think it's a good idea. There was one proposal for this in Berkeley, and it turned out that it cost the city $50,000 to do that. I think a more sensible policy to do would be to use the meter money to pay for added public services, you know, Christmas lighting, and to donate some of that money very publicly to pay for helping the homeless. I think using the meter money to help the homeless is a lot more in the Christmas spirit than saying let's make parking free for everybody who can find a space.
Soon the chain reaction started in the parking lot. Waiting to bleed onto the big streets that bleed out onto the highways and all.
That was Donald Shoup, Yale-trained economist, former chair of UCLA's Department of Urban Planning, and author of The High Cost of Free Parking. He was speaking there with Word of Mouth senior producer Rebecca Lavoie. You can find a link to more on his work, as well as some local parking peeves, at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd love to know what you think. Is a cleaner downtown worth the hassle of walking to a kiosk? Will parking changes just always get under our skin? You can send us your comments on Facebook, Twitter, or again at wordofmouthradio.org. Bullying happens everywhere, in schools, offices, online, all over the world. Here in the U.S., parents, school districts, and even the president have taken a variety of approaches to combat bullying. Sweden's federal government has created the position of ombudsman. The story of how this federally appointed advocate helped one young Swede comes to us from Latitude News.
Well, I live for music. When I've been sad at home about the bullying, I'd just been closing the door to my room and just playing music. My name is Jasmin Gustafsson, and I live in Gothenburg, Sweden, and I'm 17 years old. Since I was little, I have always listened to Amy Winehouse. This has always been my favorite. I told you I'm in trouble. When you're bullied, you always blame yourself. You always blame yourself. I can tell you one incident in the school, for an example, when I thought I would be with the other kids and jump skip rope. And I was really happy and thought it would be really fun. But instead, the kids took the rope and tried to strangle me. And I went home with a big bruise around my neck and they nearly tried to kill me. Like a usual day for me was to be beaten, so I had big bruises on my leg and arms, and I got cracked lips. In this school, there were only Swedish people. And, you know, my mom is Swedish, but my dad is from Turkey. And they didn't like it at all. They were always talking about my dad, and you know, they started to talk about my hair, too, and wanted me to cut it off and dye it blonde like a Swedish, which I did. You know, I really tried to fit in the class, but it wasn't enough. It was never enough. And it was like a game for them.
If you want something to play with, go and find yourself a toy.
My mother was in despair, and she searched on the internet. And then she found the ombudsman. The government, they have chosen a person here in Sweden to do this, take care of bullying cases. And she wrote a letter to him for help. And, you know, he began an investigation that lasted 6 months. And he decided to go to court and sue Gothenburg City for not helping me in this situation. And for the first time in your life when you're bullied, he believes in you. That was what I felt. He believed me for the first time.
Tell it like it is. Don't be ashamed. Let your conscience be your guide.
I can tell you a little story about this. When I one day passed out in school. And you know, it was all this pressure about the bullying. And the ambulance picked me up. And when I was feeling better at the hospital, I visited the music studio there. You know, they got a kids section on the hospital in Sweden where kids can read books at the library, they can do arts and craft and record a song at the music studio with a guy named Olli. And you know, I just wanted to record the song Hallelujah. And when I was done, he asked me if we can change phone number and maybe do something together in the future.
Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the manifold, the major lift, the baffled king composing Hallelujah, Hallelujah.
And yeah, now this year we got a release of a new song called Red, Gold, Green and Blue. It's the colors that shines on you when you're on stage, you know. And yeah, people trying to bring you down. But when you're on stage, you don't give a f*** about it. This is like a revenge for me. This is really like a revenge for me. When I was in school, they will see me, you know, without makeup, and I just wear black and white, you know. And it wasn't Jasmine, but here, when I'm on stage, I'm Jasmine, and now they can never bring me down again.
And that story was produced by Jack Rodoligo for LatitudeNews.com. Thanks so much for joining us today. We invite you to share what you think about what you heard on the program at wordofmouthradio.org or by posting on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio, or sending us a tweet at Word of Mouth. We're always grateful for your feedback, your new ideas, and of course, your support. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us again at 9 p.m. tonight and again tomorrow at noon for more Word of Mouth from listener-supported New Hampshire Public Radio.